Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving into a stack of sources today, all about something, well, pretty fundamental to understanding ourselves, brain networks. You've provided us with some really interesting research and notes exploring, what these networks are, how they function.
And how studying them gives us incredible insight. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's really about peering under the hood of the human brain, seeing the intricate systems that make everything happen, how we think, how we feel.
Interact with the world, all of it.
All of it.
So our mission in this deep dive is really to get to grips with the definition first. What is a brain network?
Right. Start with the basics.
Yeah, and then maybe explore how researchers even figure out these connections exist,
Now we see it, man.
and then dive into some of the big ones, the well-known examples, and see how they work together.
Sound like a plan.
Think of it as maybe getting a shortcut to understanding the complex wiring that makes us, well, us.
And the core idea from your sources, it's really foundational, is that the brain isn't just like a bag of separate parts.
Right. Not just individual regions.
Exactly. It's a dynamic system. These interconnected regions, they work together, like highly specialized teams collaborating constantly. That's really where the whole concept of networks comes in.
So let's start right there then. What exactly is a brain network according to these sources? What's the core definition we need to grasp?
Well, the sources define a brain network pretty clearly. It's a collection, basically a group of interconnected brain regions.
Okay, regions linked together.
Linked together, yeah. And they work together. They collaborate to perform specific functions. But here's the really crucial part. They aren't defined by simple anatomy. Like, you can't just point to a lump and say, that's the network.
Okay, so it's not just structure.
No, it's defined more by patterns of functional connectivity.
Functional connectivity. I like to think of that as regions talking to each other. Is that fair?
That's a great way to put it.
So how do researchers actually see this conversation happening inside someone's head?
Well, that functional connectivity, it's mainly observed through neuroimaging techniques. You've got fMRI,
Okay, the blood flow one.
right, tracking blood flow as a sort of proxy for neural activity. And then there's EEG, which measures the brain's electrical activity directly.
Brain waves.
Exactly. And researchers look for regions where the activity rises and falls together over time. That synchrony suggests they're coordinating or communicating.
Got it. So it's not just where things are, but how different parts are coordinating their activity and time, even if they're physically quite far apart in the brain.
Precisely. It's about identifying these systems, these interconnected neurons and regions that team up for specific cognitive functions or processes.
And you mentioned imaging, but are there other ways?
Well, imaging is key, but they also use computational models to try and understand the really complex patterns and dynamics involved.
Makes sense. And why is understanding this functional connectivity and the networks it reveals, why is it so important? What kind of insights does your source material say this gives us?
Oh, the sources really emphasize the value here. First, it gives us crucial insight into just healthy brain function, you know, how the typical brain manages everything from simple tasks to really complex thoughts.
Okay, the baseline.
The baseline, exactly. But just as importantly, it helps us understand various neurological and psychiatric disorders. Dysfunction often shows up as altered connectivity, either within a specific network or in the communication between different networks.
So if a network is like a team, maybe a disorder is like team members not communicating well, or maybe the wrong teams are trying to work together.
That's a fantastic analogy, yes. And understanding which network is involved in which function and how it might be misfiring, well, that opens up avenues for potential targeted interventions down the line. It helps us understand how the brain integrates information, you know, memory, attention, language, emotion. It's fundamental to everything we do.
And seeing those alterations in connectivity could be key to treatments.
Absolutely. Understanding the problem is the first step to fixing it.
Okay, that definitely lays the groundwork. We know what a brain network is fundamentally, these interconnected regions defined by their coordinated activity. Now, how do researchers actually sort of dissect and understand these complex systems? Your sources outlined a few key approaches.
Yeah, they look at it from different angles. The first one is functional connectivity, which, well, we just discussed.
Right. The talking between regions, measured by things like fMRI, looking for that correlated activity. shows how the brain coordinates tasks in real time.
Exactly. And understanding this dynamic communication is vital because, as we said, changes here are really strongly linked to many disorders.
Okay, so if that's the conversation happening now, what about the actual wires, the physical connections?
Right. That's structural connectivity. This is more like the physical wiring diagram of the brain. It's about mapping the actual anatomical connections, the bundles of nerve fibers.
The white matter tracts.
The white matter tracts, yes, that link different brain regions.
And how do you actually see those physical pathways? You can't just look, can you?
Not directly, no. That's typically measured using something called diffusion tensor imaging, DTI. It's a specialized type of MRI.
Okay.
And it tracks how water molecules move along those nerve fibers. It shows the direction and integrity of the tracks.
So structural connectivity gives us the kind of the anatomical roadmap, the foundation for the functional communication.
Precisely. It's the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And obviously, problems with the wiring itself can lead to major issues with information flow.
Makes sense. Okay, what was next? Ah, network topology. This sounds a bit more abstract, like mapping.
It is, in a way. This uses mathematical tools, actually from graph theory, to analyze the network's overall organization.
Graph theory, like nodes and edges.
It's exactly like that. It looks at how the nodes, the brain regions, are connected. It looks at the density of connections, and it helps identify hubs.
Hubs.
Yeah, hubs are regions that are really highly connected, linked to many other parts of the network.
Like the major airports or train stations in our brain city analogy?
That's a perfect way to think about it.
Yeah.
And understanding this topology, this layout, it reveals how the brain is organized for, hopefully, efficient communication and processing.
And does the structure matter, like how it's organized?
Oh, definitely. Certain network properties, like having robust hubs, are associated with how resilient a network is, mm-hmm. or how well it can adapt to change or damage.
Fascinating. Okay, so we have the real-time communication, functional, the physical pathways, structural, and the overall layout topology.
Right.
But you mentioned dynamic earlier. None of this is fixed, is it? The brain's always changing.
Absolutely not. It's constantly in flux. And that brings us to the fourth angle, dynamic networks.
Right.
The brain is not a static structure. Its connections, its communication patterns, they're constantly shifting.
You mean like second to second or over a longer time?
Both, actually. These changes can happen very rapidly depending on, say, our mental state or what task we're doing right now. But they also change over longer periods of development, learning throughout life, aging.
And why is understanding this dynamism, this constant change, so critical?
It's absolutely key to understanding flexible processes, things like learning new skills, forming memories, adapting to new situations, maybe even consciousness itself.
Wow.
And it also gives us crucial insights into how brain networks can reorganize, for instance, after an injury or with disease, or maybe even through therapy, how the brain tries to adapt.
So studying brain networks means looking at how regions talk, how they're physically wired, how the whole system is organized, and how all of that changes over time. It's quite a multidimensional picture.
It really is. And integrating these different perspectives, functional, structural, topological, dynamic, that's how researchers are building this increasingly detailed understanding of the brain's complex operating system.
All right. Well, with that foundational understanding of what brain networks are and how they're studied, Let's move on. Let's see these concepts in action by exploring some common, well-known brain networks that researchers have identified, each one linked to specific functions, right?
Exactly. And let's start with one that's maybe gotten the most attention in recent years.
Yeah.
The default mode network, or DMN.
Ah, the DMN. This is the one people often call the mind-wandering network.
Yeah.
The one that's active when you're not really focused on the outside world.
That's the one, precisely. It shows heightened activity when you're, you know, not engaged in a specific task requiring external focus. It's the network the brain seems to default to when the mind is, quote unquote, at rest.
Mm-hmm.
Or reflecting, or introspecting.
Yeah, the sources describe it as being really involved in our internal world, our sense of self.
Exactly. The DMN supports a whole range of functions tied to that internal focus. Key regions involved, according to the sources, include areas like the medial prefrontal cortex, the posterior cingulate cortex,
mm-hmm.
the precuneus, and the angular gyrus.
Mm-hmm.
Big names, but they work together.
And collectively, what do these regions let us do? What are the main functionalities of the DMN?
Okay, so the sources outlined several core functions.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeply involved in self-referential processing.
Meaning?
Thinking about yourself, your past experiences, your future possibilities, your personality, who you are, your relationships.
Which makes sense if it's active when you're not busy doing something else. You're often thinking about yourself then.
Right. It's also described as a kind of hub for your inner dialogue.
The voice in your head.
Kind of, yeah. That internal voice where you reflect, maybe plan things out, rehearse conversations, essentially construct your narrative of yourself.
And it's tied into emotional regulation, too.
Yes, particularly processing emotions that are connected to your personal experiences and memories.
Okay. And another big one is theory of mind.
Right. That's the ability to understand that other people have their own thoughts, feelings, intentions, separate from yours.
Putting yourself in someone else's shoes.
Exactly. The DMN helps you do that. It's crucial for empathy, yeah. Complex social interactions.
And the classic function, mind wandering and daydreaming.
Absolutely. Those spontaneous thoughts, just letting your mind drift. That's the DMN hard at work. But it's not just passive zoning out.
No.
No. This state is linked to creative thinking, generating new ideas, those sort of aha moments sometimes, and also future planning. By mentally simulating different scenarios.
So it's a state of active internal simulation and processing, even when it feels like you're doing nothing.
Exactly. It's also thought to be involved in memory consolidation.
That's so.
By helping integrate new experiences into your existing knowledge, transferring them to long-term memory, making sense of them, and also social cognition more broadly, understanding social cues, navigating social situations.
It's really fascinating how this default state is so fundamental to identity, memory, social connection. And the sources note its activity often goes down when other networks come online.
That's right. It typically shows an inverse correlation with task-positive networks, like the ones involved in focused attention. When you're laser-focused on an external task, the DMN often quiets down.
And that switching back and forth is key.
That dynamic switching is crucial for flexible behavior.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, dysfunction in the DMN is implicated in a range of disorders. Things like Alzheimer's disease, depression, schizophrenia.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because your sources also touched on this, this fascinating connection between the DMN, psychedelics, and the neuroscience of experiences sometimes described as enlightening.
Yeah, this is a really active and frankly compelling area of research highlighted in your sources.
Mm.
Studies using classic psychedelic psilocybin from mushrooms, LSD, have found they significantly alter DMN activity.
Right.
And these changes seem strongly linked to subjective experiences people report, often described as mystical or profoundly transformative.
What specifically did the sources point to regarding these effects on the DMN? What's happening?
Well, they highlighted a few key findings. First, there's pretty consistent evidence of reduced DMN activity.
So it gets quieter.
Yes, significantly quieter. Imaging studies show that during a psychedelic state, activity within the DMN's core regions decreases quite a bit. And this reduction is often correlated with the subjective experience of ego dissolution.
Ego dissolution.
That feeling people report where the boundaries between the self and the external world seem to blur or dissolve. The usual sense of a separate, solid identity diminishes.
So the network associated with self quiets down, and that lines up with a reduced sense of self. That correlation is pretty striking.
It is. It's a powerful link. Second, alongside that reduced DMN activity, there's often increased global connectivity.
Meaning?
While the DMN itself might be quieter, there seems to be increased communication and interaction between brain networks that don't usually talk to each other much in a typical state.
Like new highways opening up between different brain regions that are usually more separate.
That's a good analogy, yeah. This might contribute to feelings of interconnectedness or expanded awareness that people often report.
Interesting. Good one.
Third, there are noticeable changes in brainwaves observed with EEG. Studies show alterations, particularly a reduction in alpha waves.
Which are usually associated with wakeful rest.
Right, and sometimes increases in other waves like delta or gamma, which are seen in different states like deep sleep or intense meditation.
And all these neurological changes, quieter DMN, more global connections, altered brain waves, they correlate with the subjective reports people give.
Exactly. People often describe these psychedelic-induced states as profoundly meaningful, sometimes life-altering. They report experiences that share characteristics with descriptions of mystical states or even, you know, concepts like enlightenment found in various spiritual traditions.
That connection between specific network changes and such profound subjective experiences is really remarkable. But the sources were also careful to include some important caveats, weren't they? It's crucial to understand the nuance here.
Absolutely. As compelling as these findings are, The sources were very clear that it's vital to maintain a balanced perspective. They pointed out several key cautions that need to be kept in mind.
And it sounds like these points were strongly emphasized in the material you reviewed, like really important to state clearly.
They were, and for very good reason. Firstly, there's the classic point about correlation versus causation.
Right. Just because two things happen together doesn't mean one caused the other.
Precisely. While the link between DMN changes and these experiences is strong, the sources stressed we need more research to fully understand if the DMN changes cause these experiences, or if they are just one part of a larger, more complex pattern of brain activity happening under psychedelics.
That distinction is always critical in science.
Always. Secondly, the sources highlighted the subjectivity of experience. The term enlightenment itself is incredibly complex, deeply personal, and, well, highly subjective. So while psychedelics can induce experiences that share characteristics with traditional accounts, it's a major leap and a matter of ongoing debate whether they can truly replicate or lead to lasting enlightenment in that traditional sense.
And the effects aren't the same for everyone, right? Individual differences play a big role.
A huge role. The sources definitely noted that the effects of psychedelics vary widely. It depends on the individual's mindset going in, the dose, the setting, the set and setting idea. Not everyone who takes a psychedelic will have a mystical or even a positive experience. Some people have very challenging or negative ones.
And finally, the long-term effects. We don't fully know yet.
Exactly. The sources underline that much more research is needed to fully understand the long-term effects of psychedelic use on both brain function and consciousness. It's an active field, but still developing.
Those are really crucial points to remember. It's a fascinating area, no doubt, but clearly complex and needs careful, rigorous study.
It certainly highlights the potential, though, of using network analysis to shed light on even the most profound aspects of human experience.
Okay, moving from our internal world to more focused action, let's talk about the Central Executive Network, or CEN, sometimes called the Frontoparietal Network. This sounds like the brain's control center.
It really is, yeah. The CEN is basically the command center for higher order cognitive functions. It's responsible for orchestrating complex mental processes, especially when you need to focus and exert mental effort.
Okay, what kind of processes are we talking about here? Like, what does it do?
So this network is critical for things like working memory.
Holding things in mind.
Holding and manipulating information in your mind temporarily, yes. It's essential for attentional control, helping you focus on what's relevant and filter out distractions. It's heavily involved in decision making.
How so?
Evaluating options, weighing pros and cons, making choices based on your goals.
Planning and problem solving too, I assume.
Absolutely. Formulating goals, developing strategies to achieve them. Also, something called cognitive flexibility.
Which is?
Your ability to switch between different tasks or different ways of thinking. Mental adaptability. And also inhibitory control.
Stopping yourself.
Right. The ability to suppress unwanted thoughts or knee-jerk actions.
So basically, everything that requires conscious effort, focus, and mental control.
Pretty much, yeah. It's active when you're doing tasks that demand focused attention and effort. Key regions are in the prefrontal cortex and the parietal cortex.
Okay.
And they're densely interconnected to allow that complex control. And it works very closely with the DMN and the next network we should probably discuss.
And like the other networks, problems here are linked to certain conditions.
Yes, definitely. Dysfunction in the CEN is implicated in disorders like ADHD, schizophrenia, and also after traumatic brain injury.
Okay, so bringing in the network that helps us sort of prioritize and switch between that internal DMN focus and the external CEN focus, the salience network, or SSN.
Right, the salience network. It's often described as the brain's vigilant sentinel. Its primary job is to monitor everything happening both inside your body and outside in the environment and identify what's most relevant or salient at any given moment.
Salient meaning important.
Important or noticeable or relevant to your current goals or needs, yes. Or maybe just surprising or emotionally impactful.
It decides what grabs our attention.
It helps prioritize, yeah. Essentially. And a really key function, as you mentioned, is regulating the switching between the DMN, our internal focus, and the CEN, our external task focus.
So it helps decide which network should be in the driver's seat.
Exactly. Based on the incoming information, it acts like a kind of switchboard operator, maybe. Deciding which line needs attention right now.
That's a helpful analogy. What parts of the brain are key here?
The primary anchors of this network are the anterior insula, or AI.
Okay.
Which is really involved in sensing your internal bodily state interoception and processing emotions, and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, or DACC. Yeah, that's involved in monitoring for conflicts, detecting errors, and contributing to decision-making. And they work together closely to integrate all this internal and external information.
And its influence goes beyond just switching networks.
Oh, yes. It's also involved in processes like emotional regulation, partly by directing attention towards emotionally significant things. It plays a role in social cognition, helping detect and interpret social cues, and even in pain perception.
And dysfunction here is linked to, let me guess.
ADHD, and yes. Mm-hmm. Also anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, among others. Problems with correctly identifying what's salient or appropriately switching focus are common in those conditions.
So, okay, we have the internal DMN, the task-focused CEN, and the SN helping us notice what's important and switch gears. What about just plain old attention itself? That seems like its own complex thing.
It absolutely is. And attention isn't just one single network. It's generally understood as a complex interplay between primarily two major networks. The dorsal attention network, DN, and the ventral attention network, VAN.
Okay, DAN and VAN. Let's break those down. The DAN first, dorsal.
Dorsal top, exactly. The DAN is often called the top-down attention system. Think of it as your voluntary control center for attention.
What I choose to focus on.
Precisely. It's responsible for goal-directed attention when you consciously decide to focus on something specific. It's involved in maintaining sustained attention on a task and directing your attention spatially, like when you're searching for your keys in a cluttered room.
Okay.
It uses top-down control to filter out irrelevant distractions and bias your attention towards whatever is relevant to your current goal.
Like shining a spotlight where you want it to go. What are the key regions here?
Key areas include the frontal eye fields, which are involved in planning eye movements and directing attention, and the intraparietal sulcus, which is crucial for spatial processing and controlling that attentional spotlight.
Okay, so if the DAN is my voluntary spotlight, what's the VAN, ventral, bottom?
Ventral, bottom, yes. The VAN is the bottom-up system. This is the system responsible for attention being captured involuntarily by something unexpected or salient in the environment.
Okay, so when something distracts me.
Exactly. It's responsible for attentional reorienting, quickly shifting your focus when something important or surprising happens that wasn't what you're looking for or expecting.
Like that loud bang outside suddenly grabbing your attention away from this conversation.
Perfect example. That's bottom-up capture by the VAN. It acts like a kind of circuit breaker interrupting whatever the DAN was focused on.
Uh-huh.
To redirect your attention to the new, potentially important stimulus, key regions here include the temporoparietal junction, or TPJ.
TPJ.
Which integrates sensory info and detects salient events, and parts of the ventral frontal cortex involved in the actual reorienting of attention and selecting a response.
So how do these two work together, the top-down DAN and the bottom-up VAN?
They're highly dynamic and really complementary. The DAN works to maintain your focused, goal-directed attention, while the VAN acts as a monitor, constantly scanning the environment for anything surprising or important that might require you to shift that focus.
A balancing act.
Exactly. They constantly interact through feedback loops. This allows us to balance maintaining focus on our goals with being able to react quickly to unexpected, potentially critical events.
And dysregulation, problems with this balance, is linked to attentional challenges.
Yes, absolutely. Problems within either network or in the communication between the DAN and VAN are strongly implicated in attentional disorders like ADHD or conditions like spatial neglect after a stroke.
Okay. Shifting gears a bit, let's explore a network that's deeply tied to our feelings, our memories, and our motivation. The limbic network, often called the emotional brain, right?
That's a common term for it, yes. It's a really complex set of interconnected brain structures, crucial for processing and regulating emotions. But it's not just emotions.
No.
It's also critical for forming and retrieving memories, especially emotional ones, and for driving motivations. It's deeply connected to our survival instincts, our social interactions, and just our overall sense of well-being.
What are some of the main players in this this limbic system?
Well, some key structures include the amygdala.
The fear center?
Often thought of that way, yeah. It's crucial for processing fear and anxiety, forming emotional memories, and quickly detecting potential threats in the environment. Then there's the hippocampus.
Memory.
Essential for creating and consolidating new memories, learning your information, especially information with an emotional tag, and also important for spatial navigation, creating mental maps.
But the thalamus is often mentioned too, isn't it?
Yes, the thalamus acts like a major relay station for sensory information heading to the cortex. but parts of it are also involved in processing emotions and helping filter sensory input, deciding what's important enough to pass on, partly based on emotional salience.
And the prefrontal cortex, does that play a role here too?
A huge role. While we talked about it in the CEN, the prefrontal cortex is critical for regulating emotions. It interacts heavily with limbic structures like the amygdala, helping to modulate our emotional responses, apply context, and make decisions that aren't just based on raw emotion. It provides that top-down control.
So it's not just about feeling emotions, but linking them to memories, learning from them, and managing how we respond.
Precisely. It's a highly dynamic system. Information flows constantly between these structures. This allows us to experience and respond to emotions, form memories that are colored by our feelings, and make decisions that integrate emotional information. And it's heavily interconnected with other networks, like the DMN and CEN, to integrate emotional processing with our sense of self and our cognitive control.
And problems here are implicated in, well, emotional and memory disorders, I imagine.
Exactly. Dysfunction in the limbic network is implicated in a wide range of conditions, including anxiety disorders, depression, PTSD, and also memory disorders like Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, finally, let's look at the network that really drives us, the reward network. This is all about motivation and pleasure, right?
Absolutely. This network is fundamental to our motivation, our drive to seek out pleasurable experiences, and our overall sense of well-being. You could say it's the driving force behind pursuing rewarding experiences, from basic needs like food to complex goals.
What are the key components here? Where does this happen?
Well, a really central player is the ventral tegmental area, or VTA. It's a small area located deep in the midbrain.
And it's important because
it's a primary source of dopamine neurons in the brain.
Ah, dopamine, the feel-good chemical we hear so much about.
That's the one. The VTA produces and releases dopamine, which is crucial not just for feeling pleasure, but for motivation, for reinforcement learning.
Meaning learning what actions lead to good things.
Exactly. Learning to repeat actions that result in rewards. And also habit formation. A major target of that dopamine released from the VTA is the nucleus accumbens, or NAC.
Yeah.
The NAC is a core part of processing the rewarding effects of, well, almost anything rewarding. Food, sex, social interaction, achieving a goal, and unfortunately, also drugs of abuse.
Ah.
It's key in reinforcing those links between actions and rewarding consequences. And the prefrontal cortex is involved here too.
How does the PFC fit into reward?
It plays a crucial role in evaluating the potential value of rewards, considering risks, delaying gratification, and generally modulating our reward-seeking behavior based on context and long-term goals. It provides that executive oversight.
So when I say achieve a goal I've been working towards or eat something really delicious, it's this VTA NAC dopamine pathway firing, saying, that was good, do that again.
That's a pretty good summary, yes.
Yeah.
When you experience something rewarding, dopamine release from the VTA into the NAC creates that pleasurable signal and powerfully reinforces the behavior that led to it. The PFC is involved in assessing the value and deciding whether to pursue it again.
And the sources specifically highlighted the link between this network and addiction, didn't they?
They certainly did. It's a critical link. Many drugs of abuse essentially hijack this natural reward network. They cause an unnaturally large, rapid surge of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens.
Much bigger than natural rewards.
Much bigger and often faster and more reliable. This intense artificial reward signal can overwhelm the system, leading to powerful reinforcement of drug-taking behavior, eventually resulting in compulsive drug-seeking and addiction, often overriding the normal regulatory signals from the PFC.
So understanding this network is absolutely vital for understanding not just healthy motivation, but also the mechanisms behind addiction and potentially other reward-related disorders, like maybe compulsive behaviors.
Absolutely. It's key to understanding a fundamental driver of human and indeed animal behavior.
So, okay, wow. What does all of this mean? We've taken quite a deep dive into your sources here. We've explored what brain networks are these interconnected regions working together, defined by their coordinated activity, their functional connectivity, not just where they sit.
Right. And we've seen how researchers study them, looking at the real-time talking, the functional connectivity, the physical wiring, the structural connectivity.
The layout, the topology.
And crucially, recognizing that it's all constantly changing the dynamic nature of these networks.
Yeah. And then we explored some of the major players, these well-known networks, the default mode network, so fundamental to our internal world or sense of self.
Mm-hmm. The central executive network, the command center for focused thinking, planning, control.
The salience network, acting like that sentinel, helping us decide what's important and switch gears between internal and external focus.
The attention networks, Dan and Van, working together for both that voluntary spotlight focus and reacting to unexpected things.
The limbic network, our emotional core, tied so tightly to memory and motivation.
And the reward network, driving our pursuit of goals and pleasure, but also vulnerable to things like addiction.
It's really clear these aren't just, you know, abstract concepts or weird anatomical terms. They feel like the fundamental operating systems that underpin our thoughts, our emotions, our actions, how we learn, even at the really complex sense of who we are.
Absolutely. Understanding these networks helps us grasp everything from why we daydream during a boring meeting to how we manage to focus intensely in a crisis, from feeling joy or connection to struggling with anxiety or depression. From forming helpful habits to making really complex long-term plans.
And seeing how these networks interact, how they're supposed to work together dynamically, and then how their dysfunction, their miscommunication, relates to various conditions, that just opens up immense possibilities, doesn't it? For future understanding, maybe better diagnosis, maybe more targeted treatment approaches.
It really underscores just how interconnected and incredibly complex the brain is. Mm-hmm. It's not just one thing. It's this symphony of collaborating, sometimes competing networks.
Yeah, this deep dive really brings that home. The brain as a network of networks.
Constantly adapting.
Okay, so here's a final provocative thought for you, for everyone listening, to consider building right on that idea of dynamism. Given that brain networks are dynamic, that they are constantly adapting, reorganizing, forming new connections throughout our entire lives, what does that fundamental capacity for change really imply about our potential for learning, for personal growth, for recovery after injury or illness, and maybe even for deliberate self-transformation?